This is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National. I'm Keri Phillips.
This is coffee.
Coffee first thing in the morning, a coffee on the train to work, and a coffee as soon as I get to work. I have quite a few in the morning just to get me going.
If you drink too many, you reach a point that you know you drank too many. I'm a bit too wired now.
Our story begins here with coffee. Its flavor caught in the closed fist of the bean, freed then by the grinding mills in an endless cascade, brewed into a beverage that is consumed in the hundreds of millions of cupfuls each day.
For many of us, daily life would be unthinkable, even impossible, without coffee. And you could argue that the modern economy relies on workers energized by the caffeine it contains. In itself, coffee is a big business. Coffee beans are second only to oil as the most important commodity in world trade. And there's a huge market for coffee house chains like Starbucks and for expensive equipment for making coffee at home. Today, while we'll touch on the economic and the health strands in the story of coffee, Rear Vision looks more closely at the social and cultural history of the drink, tracking the changes in the way we drink it and how we think about it. Mark Pendergrast is the author of Uncommon Grounds, The History of Coffee and How It Transformed Our World.
Well, we know that coffee is native to Ethiopia, to the mountains of Ethiopia. There is a creation myth, which I'm quite fond of, and which is actually mildly plausible, that there was a goat herd named Kaldi who saw his goats frisking about and acting weird and not answering him. And they were eating the leaves and the berries from this understory shrub. In other words, there are taller trees in the rainforest canopy above it with red berries and glossy green leaves. And so he tried it, and that's how coffee was discovered. No one knows exactly when or how coffee was discovered. What we do know is that by the early 1500s, somebody had figured out to roast it the way that we know it and to make it into the brew that we know now. Because in 1511, it was so popular in Mecca that it was banned by the governor, who felt that it was a bad influence on the people who were writing seditious poetry and nasty things about him, and he didn't appreciate it.
Enthusiasm for coffee drinking spread from the Arab world to Europe.
Yeah, well, it spread from Ethiopia to Yemen, just across the Red Sea at some point. And then during the Ottoman Empire, you know, the Turks and the Arabs had a monopoly on coffee, which they were fairly careful about keeping. They didn't export any fertile beans. They would parboil them or blanch them before they were exported, so they were not fertile. But inevitably, that monopoly was broken, reputedly first by an Indian pilgrim named Baba Budan, who took some fertile seeds to India, and then by the Dutch, who began to grow them in their hothouses. And it became popular in England and in the rest of Europe about 1650. So between 1650 and 1700, coffee and tea and chocolate all took Europe by storm, but particularly coffee, and particularly in England. So that by the year 1700, some sources say that there were as many as 2,000 coffee houses in London alone. And I argue in my book that it really had a remarkable impact on Western civilization. Because up until that point, people drank a lot of alcoholic beverages, so that they were not very sober most of the time. And I don't think it's too much of a coincidence that the burgeoning of the Enlightenment happened about the same time that coffee became very popular. So you saw Lloyd's Coffee House being the beginnings of Lloyd's of London. There was really the birth of newspapers and magazines were in coffee houses. Bach and Beethoven composed to coffee, and the French and the American revolutions were planned in coffee houses. So they really have had a major impact upon our way of life.
In the coffee houses of Europe, the beverage had, through guilt by association, built on its reputation for fermenting rebellion. You can also see the seeds of the continuing debate over possible health risks.
Well, everybody knew that it must have something in it, some kind of drug. So one of the controversial aspects about coffee has always been that some people think it's really terrible for you, and some people think that it's like the panacea that cures all ills. And that's been true since the onset. One of the funny stories I found was that in 1674, the women of London who were not allowed into the coffee houses unless they worked in them complained that the coffee was emasculating their men, making them impotent so that their sex lives were being ruined. The men answered with their own pamphlet saying that that was not true at all, that coffee made them superior lovers and added spiritualescency to the sperm. It's hard to say that.
Bennett Weinberg, with Bonnie Beeler, is author of The World of Caffeine, The Science and History of the World's Most Popular Drug. He says you can't really talk about coffee without talking about caffeine.
Caffeine was first isolated at the beginning of the 19th century. In 1819, a man named Runge, who was a medical student in Germany, discovered caffeine, and he discovered it because Goethe, who was a great intellectual leader at the time, became curious about what made coffee do what it does. And he called the young Runge into his office, and he threw him a bag of mocha coffee beans, and he said, look into this and find out why coffee does what it does. And within a very short time, Runge had isolated the caffeine molecule, and that was, in fact, the beginning of our understanding of what was going on. And it wasn't long before the same molecule was isolated in tea and cocoa and guarana and mate, and it was understood that caffeine was the active ingredient in all of these.
At the same time as the elites in Europe were drinking their boiled and bitter brews in coffee houses, colonial entrepreneurs were establishing coffee plantations in places like Java, Sumatra, and of course, Latin America.
It became a big business. So it began to be cultivated in sort of a girdle between the tropics of Capricorn and the tropics of Cancer. It's a tropical product. It grows best between 3,000 and 6,000 feet high on volcanic mountainsides. For that reason, to this day, it's usually grown in absolutely beautiful places that are incredibly impoverished. So the irony implicit in all of coffee history is that it's grown by very poor people and it's consumed by relatively wealthy people, so that, for instance, the average person growing coffee makes less than $3 a day, in other words, less than what we often pay for one cup of coffee. And the history of coffee is rife with oppression of these people. The Dutch enslaved the natives of the East Indies in order to make their coffee, and then the Portuguese brought slaves to Brazil, which became the world's largest coffee-growing country by the end of the 1800s. And to this day, there are these disparities built into coffee.
However grim these colonial plantations, the beans grown allowed coffee to become a drink for the masses, especially in the US, according to David Courtwright, the author of Forces of Habit, Drugs and the Making of the Modern World.
Oh, yeah. The United States is very, very close to major sources of cheap coffee in the Western Hemisphere. In other words, the French started growing lots of coffee on what is now Haiti, and the Brazilians started producing coffee under the Portuguese. And in fact, about 40% of the arable land in northern Latin America is currently given over to coffee cultivation. So it's historically, at least since the early 19th century, it's just been dirt cheap in the Americas. Whereas in the British Empire, tea was often the preferred or the cheaper commodity. So part of it is just a matter of availability and cost.
This is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National. I'm Keri Phillips, and today it's a history of coffee, the way we drink it and the way we think about it. In In continental Europe, coffee became popular with a workforce that had become increasingly urbanized. By the dawn of the 20th century, in Europe and the US in particular, coffee was widely drunk in all spheres of society. In Italy, where a primitive kind of espresso machine had been developed to serve a quick coffee in what were known as American bars, coffee took a great leap forward with the invention of a new kind of machine by Achille Gaggia. Professor Jonathan Morris from the University of Hampshire directs a research project on espresso drinks called the Cappuccino Conquests, a transnational history of Italian coffee.
The original espresso machines are those very sort of big, tall, upright machines that we sometimes see in old pictures. And these are the ones that basically have a boiler at the bottom and boil up the water from there. Just after the end of the Second World War, in fact, really the design had been worked on before that period, Achille Gaggia brought out a new style machine, and this is the first one to do this thing of really pressurizing the water before blasting it through the coffee. So that rather than using steam to push the water through the coffee, what was used was to sort of pressurize the water, and by using a pump handle. So that if you think of those big handles on the old-fashioned espresso machines, almost like a sort of a barmaid pulling a coffee, that puts the coffee through at a far higher pressure and produces what we would now think of an espresso, because it actually, at that kind of pressure, produces that little head of crema on the top of the drink. So that's a big sort of breakthrough. It really changes the nature of espresso. And at the same time, we're really heading from 48 as the first machine that comes out into the 1950s as the economy recovers from the war. So these machines began to spread not only in Italy, but also very quickly were exported outside to the rest of the world.
One of those places was, of course, Australia, and we'll hear more about that in a moment. The ability of these new machines to create crema ultimately caused a coffee revolution.
Well, the crema is significant because it contains quite a lot of the kind of essential oils that are being extracted from the coffee. So that gives it a lot of what we, if you like, taste in the coffee, and also what we smell in the coffee is actually in the crema, in these essential oils. The crema also obviously has a visual effect, so that in fact when this new style of espresso was first produced, it was actually known as crema café, or café crema, so that it's sort of cream coffee, and it was actually marketed as a new style of coffee. There was already a beverage known as espresso, because that's what's coming out of the machines from the beginning of the century. So now the new style, what we now still refer to as espresso, is marketed as sort of café crema, and that's really the primary beverage. On the other hand, these machines do have a steam handle. And once the machines start going abroad, particularly to the English-speaking countries, then that sort of steam wand is used for frothing milk, and that's what enables the production of sort of cappuccino, which is really the drink that actually takes off around the rest of the world.
A dream of Paris, expressed in café au lait, a continental favorite, half coffee and half hot milk. Canals of Venice and the romance of cappuccino, like café au lait, but topped with whipped cream and a sprinkle of grated orange peel. The music of old Vienna in a cup. Viennese coffee, often spiced, but always with a drift of whipped cream.
The spread of the commercial espresso machine had opened up endless possibilities for innovation. Many of the variations involved adding milk to espresso, sweetening it and diluting it. In Australia, we invented the flat white and the long black. In the US, cinnamon was sprinkled on cappuccinos, while the British decided it had to be a much hotter drink so that you could linger over it in the cafe. Whatever the permutation, these drinks and the places they were served in gained cachet from the association with the sophistication and culture of Italy.
in Sydney in 1955, the first Gudja machine in Sydney was actually at David Jones, which a lot of people are quite surprised by that because they think, oh no, there must have been some lovely little Italian shop in Leichhardt that was serving coffee first. And there may well have been, but this wasn't recognised by the press in Sydney.
Tanya Camerano is the editor of the recipe website taste.com.au. She looked at the history of coffee in Australia for her master's degree in gastronomy at the University of Adelaide.
In Sydney, you had department stores very important in the spread of espresso and in making it seem a trendy, exciting drink because department stores brought glamour and sophistication and were often bringing all sorts of new innovations to Australia. The scene in Melbourne, you see, are much more, I use the word authentic, but what is authenticity? That's another argument. But I guess the scene in Melbourne came very much from those small Italian roasters, distributors and makers of coffee, and they were small Italian shops that seemed to attract a mainstream clientele, where in Sydney you seem to have Italian places where the Italian migrants would go that were largely ignored by the mainstream press, and then you had glamorous department stores and independent espresso bars that traded on those high ideals of Italy that were around at the time, so, you know, La Dolce Vita and that sort of thing.
Do we have any idea who imported the first Gudjas to Australia?
Well, the first Gudjas, I think, were imported to Australia by the Bancrofts. So they got the license for Gudja in London in the early 50s, and they were in Melbourne. A lot of espresso machines were brought to Australia not through official channels, so there's no real way of us knowing where they were. There's no dates, there are no newspaper articles, people's memories. I mean, it's like any sort of history. And I think, too, when you're dealing with migrant histories, you know, migrants came here because they had to make more money. I don't think they were that concerned with writing down their history at that time. And there was racism, too. So what they did was ignored by the mainstream.
To go back to the story in the US, drinking coffee had been seen almost as a patriotic duty ever since the Boston Tea Party in 1773. And the Civil War in the 1860s opened up new technological possibilities.
You know, war frequently produces technological advances of one sort or another. And because coffee was so popular with the Yankee troops, they wanted it more conveniently. And so you developed the paper bag and the industrial roaster during the war, and it was really the beginning of the burgeoning of mass-produced products with brand names. So some of the most famous coffees, such as Maxwell House, Hills Brothers, and Folgers, all originated in the late 1800s. You also at that time had steamships, railroads coming in. It was really the beginning of mass marketing and advertising. So Americans have always sort of run on coffee, and we were very proud of the fact that we boiled it and boiled it and made it rather terribly strong. Not very good, but strong. So it was sort of like the coffee that fueled the cowboys in the West over their campfires and things like that. So by the time of World War II, Americans were drinking more coffee per capita than anyone else in the world.
This is the coffee pot at work. Listen to it perk. Look at the coffee as it gets darker and stronger. Smell the honest coffee smell. Ah, smell it. But will this cup of coffee taste as good as it smells? You bet it will, because it's Maxwell House, the coffee that tastes as good as it smells every time.
After World War II, it's sort of a sad story in the United States. We took what was already sort of mediocre coffee that we didn't brew very well, and we did two terrible things to it. One, we began to brew it with percolators, which sort of recycles it and makes it more and more bitter. But the worst thing we did was to begin adding Robusta beans to our blends. Now, there are two types of coffee. The kind that's native to Ethiopia is called Arabica, and it is by far superior in taste and in quality to Robusta, which is native to the Congo and which grows at a lower altitude and is more resistant to disease. It has twice as much caffeine and doesn't taste as good. But what happened after World War II was that instant coffee had become quite popular during the war, And instant everything became popular in the 50s because, you know, you're supposed to have TV dinners and minute rice and everything was supposed to be modern. Well, instant coffee was such a terrible product that it didn't matter whether you put Arabica or Robusta in it. It tasted lousy anyway, so why not put cheap beans in? Then they began to put the cheap beans into the regular brew. And so by 1962, coffee in the United States was being served very dilute because it tasted so bad. The per capita consumption was going down, and it had an image of being this sort of bitter, old-fashioned drink of boring businessmen and gossipy housewives. And so the baby boomers turned to Coca-Cola and Pepsi for their caffeine hit for quite some time. And it wasn't until really the 70s and 80s that the hippies began to rediscover really, really good coffee. And that was sort of the beginning of Starbucks and what is now called the specialty coffee revolution.
You're listening to Rear Vision on ABC Radio National. Keri Phillips here with the social and cultural history of coffee. Increased international travel during the 60s and 70s had introduced many more Americans to delicious Italian coffee, and they became a growing market, first for the beans sold in gourmet shops and then specialty coffee houses.
Right, well, the big story in the 1980s is really what happens is the kind of the coffee revolution that really starts, I guess we have to say, in the States. But if we look at particularly the States from the 80s, we have this thing of the takeoff of the idea of sort of a specialty coffee. That coffee should be savored as a kind of a gourmet product. Independent coffee operators began to try and sell gourmet coffee. Really, gourmet coffee is beans. So the idea that you had, you know, a single origin coffee, that you had coffee that came from a particular region, often not that sophisticated, flavored coffee and so forth. But what they began to do, having started by trying to sell beans, they would also serve samples of their coffee in their coffee shops, in some of these sort of gourmet retailers, and in starting to set up places which in effect became coffee shops in the way that we know them today. They also put in espresso machines as much for, as was widely said at the time, the theater of the machine, as much as actually thinking it would really get a lot of orders for espresso. But in fact, that's exactly what happened. Not so much for espresso, but for cappuccino and for this beverage that became very popular, cafe latte, which in a sense is even sweeter than cappuccino and therefore even easier to consume. So we had this sort of appearance of a more sophisticated notion of coffee at the center of the offer, a kind of a gourmet specialized coffee, and that was sold through the motor of these espresso-based beverages, predicated on really two things, I think. One, that you certainly couldn't make them at home, and therefore they tasted very different from anything you could make at home. And two, that because in a way they could be presented as very artisanal, that the barista made the drink for you, that the way that you saw particularly the use of the milk, both in terms of the frothing, but also in terms of the pouring, the creation of latte art, this kind of, all adds a lot of value to the coffee itself. And of course, once you add value to the coffee, you can start charging extra for that.
The success of Starbucks inspired a wave of imitators. In the UK, there's Cafe Nero and Costa, Gloria Jean's here in Australia. Even in India, traditionally a tea-drinking country, there are two chains, Cafe Coffee Day and Barista, although the latter has been bought by the Italian company Lavazza. And if you look at what's on offer, hot and cold coffees blended with everything from chocolate and vanilla to mango and raspberries, you'll find lots of drinks, again, you can't easily duplicate at home. As with almost anything to do with coffee, though, opinions about chain coffee shops are divided.
The notion of the coffee shop as somewhere where you would like to go and spend 20, 30 minutes and creating an atmosphere that you would like to be in for 20 or 30 minutes is actually critical to their success. And indeed, if you think of some of the auxiliary services that they can provide, that has also helped. And so not only the obvious ones that have in a sense been used by coffee houses over the centuries, the provision of newspapers, the possibilities to listen to music, but also more recently, these things have evolved quite closely together in the sense of the evolution of, for example, the laptop computer and the wireless connection had actually made it easier for people to think, well, we can go and work in the coffee shop. I can go and have my meeting in the coffee shop or so forth. And all of these things have facilitated that growth.
You know, in the United States, the only thing comparable had been soda fountains during the 50s, but then those went out. There really wasn't a place where you could go and intergenerations could comfortably talk. You only had bars, which were rather unsavory places. So the coffee house really has provided what one sociologist calls the great good place, the third place, not work, not your home, where you can go and meet somebody and kind of a nice setting. So you have a lot of business people, a lot of dates, a lot of just friends meeting at coffee houses now. I'll tell you, this is just personally, both of my daughters like to go out to just have coffee. I make wonderful coffee, but when they're visiting me, they don't drink it because they want to go out for their experience, you know, in the morning. They'll go jogging and have a cup of coffee that they purchase somewhere else. So I think it's just part of the ritual of people's lives to go out for a cup of coffee. I would say that there definitely is some kind of pull to getting your coffee and talking to the barista and saying, I want it prepared in this special way, and I'll take this, that, and the other, and oh, I want one of those biscotti, et cetera. So it's a kind of a, you know, a special experience. It's kind of like the difference between watching a movie on your television screen and going out and seeing it on the big screen.
I could be wrong about this, but I sense a shift away from the social dimension of coffee, partly as a result of new technologies like cheap drip coffee pots that you could, or percolators that you could use in your own home. The social dimension of coffee drinking is probably less pronounced now than it was 150 or 200 or 250 years ago. In other words, a lot of people will just go into Starbucks and they'll buy a coffee and they'll get in the car, or they'll drink a cup of coffee at their desk, and it's not necessarily something they do with the companionship of other people. The sociability of coffee has, to some degree, disappeared. In fact, I'm struck now. I walk into Starbucks, and what do I see? Do I see people talking? No, I see people pecking away at their laptops, drinking their coffee, and not paying much attention to one another. So, yes, there have been changes in attitudes towards coffee, and there have been changes in the way that it's been used.
Australians are drinking a lot more coffee. Consumption per capita has doubled over the past 30 years here, and more than a billion cups of coffee are consumed in cafes, restaurants, and other places each year, an increase of 65% over the past 10 years. And for some of us now, drinking coffee can be discussed with the same kind of nuance and sophistication that others use to talk about wine. Although you'd have to think that a lot of Australians must be turning out some pretty impressive espressos and lattes at home, it has to be said that instant coffee still makes up 80% of sales in Australia, reflecting similar trends in places like the UK and the States. And for many of us, the most important thing about coffee is that it's an energizer. It lifts our mood and keeps us going. You can find the names of my guests and the details of their books on our website. You'll find some links to interesting coffee-related sites there, and you can also post a comment if you want. Just go to the Radio National website and choose Rear Vision from the program menu. Timothy Nicastri was the sound engineer on Rear Vision today. I'm Keri Phillips.
Next on the Health Report, a world first from Western Australia, which could mean more families know if they're at increased risk of a long list of cancers. But do they really want to know? And what do they have to fess up to insurers, employers and even prison authorities? Plus, with all this high-tech genetic research going on, what if a new discovery is made in you? Should you be told? You'd be surprised what some researchers have done. Or maybe you wouldn't be. Anyway, a feisty health report for you if you download a podcast from Radio National's website.